and welcome to Tigers by the Fire, a podcast out of Holy Cross High School about World War II discussions and stories. This is episode 4 of season 4, and we're going to be talking about the 442nd Regiment, which is a pretty cool topic. And with me are Bryce.
Hello.
And Alex.
Hello.
And this is a topic that I think is really neat because obviously this is a very well-distinguished unit, one that had to go through a lot of, I guess, adversity even to exist. And it makes a huge difference in the war. And really, these guys who go over there in the 442nd, they're one of the most recognized units in all of World War II. And, you know, it's obvious. I'm not going to spoil the whole story. I'll let you guys kind of tell that. So Alex, I'll let you kind of start us off with what it is and why it's significant.
All right. The 442nd Regiment is an infantry regiment of the United States during World War II. It first began when Theodore Roosevelt initiated the Executive Order 966 on February 19th, 1942, after the attack on Pearl Harbor by Imperial Japan. After the attack on Pearl Harbor, all the Japanese Americans faced segregation, like racial segregation, from the American people out of fear of them being spies. They would outright avoid them if any Japanese American businesses were happening during that time. They would completely stop buying any products from there and cause that business to shut down. And there was this mass panic around by the people in America, by the Japanese people.
Yeah, and to your point, the boycotts of Japanese businesses, it started a little bit before, but on the West Coast, which is where we're kind of looking at, especially with
California.
They're going to boycott Japanese businesses, and with the executive order that eventually puts them into incarceration camps, you have a lot of people who lose their homes. They lose farms in particular. There was a boycott on Japanese American farm goods. And I think it's important to remember too that these are American citizens. I mean, these are Americans. They're not Japanese. They're just of Japanese descent. And the panic, as you said, you used that word correctly, the panic after Pearl Harbor was for a lot of these Americans on the West Coast to start to blame Japanese Americans, and that's really sad.
Yeah, it even got really bad that even like celebrities at that time were talking about it too, talking like trying to blame Japanese for their faults.
Yeah, it didn't have any kind of limitations. There's stuff in pop culture, pop media, on the radio they were doing it, and even in movies. And yeah, it was a big push. And California is really kind of like the place where that is. And there's a lot of documentation. The governor of California had been trying to diminish Asian immigration into California for years. And he uses this as almost like a push to try and get rid of a lot of these people, which is really sad.
Yeah. The final attack on Pearl Harbor was the final push for that.
Correct. Correct.
And, a lot of people didn't really, accept them even when they first got there, because California was the main place of Japanese descent starting a life in America. They would travel to America to start a new life. And so when World War II happened and Japan is attacking China and everything, that just caused all of them to be hated by the American people.
Really, like it was like a tipping point, you could say, because that discrimination, like not wanting them to be there, was already there, but like they just need like that one little knife in the back for it to be fully there.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, because if you look at it, the discrimination is there. There's already, you know, anti-Japanese sentiment, anti-Japanese laws, and Pearl Harbor just gives them the push, the incentive, like you said, that little just to push right off the ledge to do it. Obviously, I mean, not to downplay Pearl Harbor, it's a huge event. Obviously puts us into a war, and that's a massive thing. But I think it's important that you guys are pointing out that some of these prejudices already pre-existed, and that's why, you know, it's going to go as far as it goes. So what happens? You said they boycott the businesses.
Yes.
So FDR then signs an executive order. And so what are they going to do to Japanese Americans?
Yeah, executive order in 1966. Yeah, it was basically putting all Japanese Americans in concentration camps.
The historical term that they like to use now, and this has changed multiple times. Like when I was in school, it was internment, then it went concentration. The big one that I've been told to use is incarceration, because they are technically incarcerated. They are arrested. Yes. So it's incarceration camps would be the term. And that's I think the one we'll go with. So yeah, they put them into these civilian incarceration camps. Mm-hmm. Why are they doing that?
Still out of fear, and also to keep a close eye and like a watch on the Japanese people in case they're still fearing that they'll all be spies for mm-hmm. Japan, and so they would keep them all in one place and keep a close eye on them to make sure they don't spread any like intel, any like war plans, anything to Japan.
And the really crazy thing about the executive order was that it was labeled as a military thing for just to like consolidate military things under military things, but in all truth, it was just used as concentration camps.
Yeah, and they're a little fearful of Japanese Americans being used in sabotage in manufacturing. The funny thing is, though, when you do research on this, there's no actual evidence to say that this was going on. Most of these people, if not all, they all left Japan for very real reasons, and usually they're not positive. And so there really wasn't this like blind loyalty that people had thought, and there really wasn't a need to do this, which is just, you know, obviously you guys said it at the beginning, this was really kind of started as a result of some racial ideology, some racial policies that kind of went into play. And so for these Japanese Americans, they're in these camps, and obviously this is going to set us up for the creation of the 442nd, because obviously the war starts to go on and there's a manpower shortage.
Yes, exactly. And so while all the Japanese are in incarceration camps, the majority of them are starting to like hate the U.S. government and like starting to like hate being there. But when the military came in and asked them who would like to join the U.S. military for this new regiment, a lot of people like did not want to join. They didn't do it. Some people did join because they thought they can restore their honor and like to be a true American and to prove to the American people that their loyalty is to America. And so they wanted to prove that their loyalty.
Yeah, and to your point, that's an individualized kind of incentive. We don't have really there's really not that many like reliable statistics as to how Japanese Americans felt as they're in the camps. I mean, they have some, they're not happy, obviously. These are miserable. They're very hot. They're cramped up. They're in communal showers, these big communal dormitories. And it's a problematic situation, to say the least. But then when they come in with the army, the bigger question then becomes, okay, are you going to enlist? And then it's the individual person, right? Because you have family pressure. I mean, you guys have probably experienced family pressure in your life at various times, right? And sometimes your family wants you to do things. And so for some people, their family was like, you need to go serve. And they have to balance their own dislike of what's going on to service. Or the opposite happens. They want to serve, but their family's like, why would you serve this country? And there's really no good statistic. There's no like one size fits all version of the story. But the 442nd, you get these volunteers who are coming from a situation where they and their families are incarcerated. They're imprisoned, and they're going to go participate and fight in this war in some of the most violent places on Earth. Yeah. So,
another thing, the main thing to point out about them coming to them is that they wanted a 3,000 recruitment from the Japanese Americans, but they only got 1,200 who came instead.
Yeah, and they were hoping to get a larger number, and I think, but you can't really blame them, you know. And I think that's the story for a lot of minority groups in World War II, and we're going to talk about this in class a lot in the next semester as we kind of really get into that American mobilization. Do you volunteer for a segregated army? where you may or may not be getting paid as much. You're probably not getting the same equipment, and you're going to be put in more adverse situations. And so for a lot of people, they say no. And it's hard to really fault them for that. And I always like to make sure we point that out. But for the guys who do enlist, they create a pretty elite unit by the end of this. So it's a pretty interesting story.
And I'd like to add on about the 44th Regiment before they start training that. The majority of the 442nd Regiment was made up of Hawaiian-born, the Nessie, they called them. Yes. Two-thirds of them being from the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. Well, and the Nessie from the mainland. And it was actually a funny thing about, like, the mainlanders nicknamed Katonks,
mm-hmm.
which for the islands represented the sound of their hollow heads when they hit the floor. And the Hawaiian Islands were called Buddha Heads because they were massive gamblers. And then that literally goes into like their catchphrase or motto, go for bro, because the Hawaiian Islands always betted everything.
Yeah, and the gambling part is a funny one. The Nisei, that term Nisei, is those Japanese Americans that are born here, right?
Yes.
And so that's the one thing they're trying to point out with that, and that's the majority of them. And yeah, there are a lot of people from Hawaii that are going to represent in this group, and they're like smaller amounts from the states by proportion, but Hawaii by proportion actually has I want to say the largest enlistment by Japanese Americans.
Yeah, two-thirds.
Yeah, yeah, they represent the largest in the unit as well.
Oh, and when the army came to the Hawaiians, their set goal for recruitment was 1,500, but the Hawaiians made over 10,000.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, and that's something that we see in Hawaii, where they do get a good amount to go in, because obviously the war starts there. But the interesting part though is that Pearl Harbor is, you know, where this starts, but the 442nd isn't really going to be fighting Japan though, right? No, where are they going to be?
No, they're mainly about all the battles are going to be in.
It's mainly on the French and the Italian campaign.
Correct.
First,
yeah.
The Italian campaign.
Yeah, the Italian campaign is where they really cut their teeth. That's the initial stages. And then at the end, they're in Lost Battalion, all these other places in northern Western Europe. So, no, very good.
Yeah, the 442nd RCT considered multiple units, including the 522nd Field Artillery Battalion, 232nd Combat Engineer Company, 206th Army Ground Forces Band, an anti-tank company, cannon company, a service company, a medical detachment, and three infantry battalions. And like you said, our mainly focus was the Battle Italy and the French fronts, and they really did not want them to fight in the Japanese fronts because it was mainly because of confusion,
or it's probably just like how it's more just they probably like think, ooh, they probably, if we send them there, they might get more people because spies.
So did the army have that same problem with sending Italian Americans to Italy?
No, but okay. So
or German Americans to Germany?
Okay, well, but here's the thing: for Italian Germans, there really isn't no distinction from the white Americans in America because, well, you can't really tell the difference between them. Right? It's all more about nationality. Yeah.
So what's the underlying factor as to why they're not going to send them there? I mean, this is very racially motivated, right? It's the idea that they don't. In the U.S. High Command does not believe that these people are entirely loyal if they were going to have to go against say a Japanese unit, and so it's an unfounded kind of belief. And there are going to be some Japanese Americans who do serve in the Pacific, and they serve very well. But the belief was that they weren't going to be allowed to do that. So they trained them. And these again, coming from the West Coast, coming from Hawaii, and they're going to ship them 3,000 miles across the continent, then 3,000 miles across another ocean to do that. That's kind of the rationale. You can't be afraid to kind of point that out. It is definitely a racially motivated rationale. But, I mean, you have first-generation Italian immigrants who serve for the U.S. and Italy, and first-generation German immigrants who serve for the U.S. and Germany. So it's not – it's not going to be something that we worry about necessarily with the Europeans. And part of that is a look thing. I think that is part of it.
Since now they got it on to the Italian and the French campaign, the first of their major battles was part of the Italian campaign on June 26th of 44 at the Italian town of Belverde. Mm-hmm. It was being held by highly trained German troops. But as always, the motto, go for broke, they just went full force into it anyway. And along with the 100 infantry, which will later be absorbed into them, they knocked out the right flank, which took very few hours to do.
Mm-hmm. So a couple things that they do in Italy that are pretty neat. Well, one is they're going to help break the Gothic line. The Gothic line was a defensive line that the Germans set up in Italy. And it's along these like mountainous ridges. And the 442nd and members of that group are going to actually scale the back end of that mountain and flank the Germans. And they're going to dislodge them. It was a 4-month stalemate. They dislodge them in something along the lines of 2 hours. And it's a pretty remarkable story. When we talk about them fighting in Italy, you don't want to oversimplify it. Italy is one of the most violent campaigns the U.S. military has ever fought. It's in this very like mountainous, it gets cold a lot. It's very hard fighting. The Germans actually resist under General Kesselring, the guy in charge of it. And they just set up this huge defensive grid. And the 442nd is one of those groups that has to go in and really punch out, knock out the Germans in there alongside other soldiers as well. But they definitely go in and sacrifice a lot. And they lose a lot of people. Upwards of a fourth, I think, of their unit is going to be knocked out in Italy.
Just like a lot of the times, like the 422nd, like they would just like send them in on like harsh terrain and like as like a main force to push into Italy, and it was like a lot of times suicidal to even push like these mountainous terrains and to go attack a lot of these settlements.
Yeah, and that's ultimately like the difficulty of it is that you have to traverse all of this stuff. And then I always like I have a picture on my back wall where it's, you look at it, it's in June and it looks really cold. And it's in Italy, it's on June 18th in 44, and that's the 442nd. And it looks like it's like the Battle of the Bulge, but it's actually just in the mountains in Italy because the higher altitude you get, the colder it gets. And that's where a lot of those things are. And then the mud, they get a lot of mudslides and stuff, and it causes all sorts of issues with the soldiers. And then the Germans are usually at elevated positions and they're shelling them repeatedly with artillery. And so it creates some pretty horrible situations for these guys.
And another of the battles was the capturing of Rome with the 36th infantry team, in which they fought to liberate French towns of the Briars and the Bifinante. Mm-hmm. These battles were brutal. We're fighting at times where them fighting at times for like house to house.
Yes.
With a lot of casualties, but even through all that, they still succeeded in liberating it.
Yeah, they play a huge role in the liberation of Rome and a number of other places. In that like house-to-house fighting, I'm glad like as you guys researched, you got to see that. That's always stressful for the soldiers because then it's what every room could be an ambush, and there could be Germans there, there could be Italians there, there could just be civilians there. And so it's a highly stressful situation. But yeah, they go through that really horrible stuff. I know you guys do have a story... What about the Lost Battalion in October? Yes. Yeah, I think that's one of their coolest stories. So yeah, let's hear about that.
So in October 27, 1944, the 442nd Regiment was sent through the Voisin Forest near the border of France and Germany in a rescue attempt of the 141st Infantry Regiment, which later then became called the Lost Battalion. And this was a... Like the terrain was just awful. Like they were cutting through trees, went through paths with foliages of darkness while enduring like rain that was cold as ice. and even further being slowed down by mines that were placed down. They did make it to the ridge, though, where the Germans surrounded the 41st, and battle did ensue with many soldiers being killed and wounded by Nazi artillery and even more mines. The regiment kept on tanking, but they still weren't able to break through. And so for 2 days, they was just at like a standstill.
Mm-hmm.
But on the third day, they went onto the enemy position. And moving against the Germans, they made it to Hill 617. And this is where the story actually gets good, where I would say this part of the battle was like, it felt like 80s action hero movie vibes right now. Because
it had all the action.
No, because it was Sylvester Stallone or Arnold Schwarzenegger type action. Like this one man, George Saccanato. He first one that came up to the hill and single-handedly just tore through, like killed 12 enemy soldiers and just wounding two and then capturing four prisoners. And that was really, like, because you never hear any of that.
Yeah.
Because this doesn't seem real.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this seems out the hornet, which is like, that actually made me get really invested in this battle, because that was something.
Yeah, yeah. In his story, it, like you said, it kind of does play out like an action movie. I've always said, and I remember when I was at the museum over the summer and they were going through that Go for Broke exhibit when they were first starting to really organize it, we were talking, and that was one of the things that we had kind of said, like, this is crazy that they really haven't had a movie about this, because this unit does so many different things that you could easily make a really good, and just by this guy, a really entertaining action movie, but you could make a pretty serious war movie off of their achievements. And when they do at the end of that, right, they get the Nazis out of that position, they help relieve a surrounded unit. I mean, they get all of these different awards, but what's crazy is they're not going to get like the Congressional Medal of Honor and all that stuff yet. Most of that stuff's going to happen much later in the 90s, really 80s and 90s. Reagan starts it, then Bush and Clinton kind of finish the awards and everything else. So they don't get recognized at the moment. They will get a lot of unit citations, and they will get Purple Hearts and things like that.
Yeah.
4,000 to be exact. Yeah,
4,000 Purple Hearts, 4,000 Bronze Stars, 560 Silver Star Medals, 21 Medals of Honor, and 7 Presidential Unit Citations.
Yeah, it's the single highest decorated ground unit in the whole war.
By far, because of all like they've done and what they've went through throughout the entire war, and also like even before that, like it's insane how they still like went through of joining the military and still went through all that, like terrain, the battles, the mentality of it all is insane. Mm-hmm. And they still push through until the very end.
And our dear friend Zagato, for his, by all accounts, beyond heroism right there, he was awarded with the Distinguished Service Cross.
Yep.
Which was a major win for them, honestly.
Yeah,
a major win for them, because that's the second highest military decoration for soldiers.
And correct. And actually, they don't give out the Medal of Honor too often to people from the same unit, especially in the same battle. But they post at the end of it, like I said, in the 80s and 90s, they started to reassess and look at the reports that these guys did. And part of it is that they're put in these really horrible situations, and they're put in, you know, doing these extreme things, and they come through again and again and again. And I mean, it's really a testament to perseverance, because like we said at the beginning, these are guys whose families, some of which were arrested by the same government they're fighting for, right?
Yes.
And you guys got to see the Go for Broke exhibit at the museum, the National World War II Museum, a couple months ago. How did that exhibit, I guess, impact you, like seeing, especially they have the line with all the medals, then they have like the pictures and the stories about the individuals. How did that exhibit impact you guys?
I will say it was stunning and also shocking how like one regiment can get so many. And also just looking through all the pictures and all the biographies of these people, they like it shows their determination of like them saying they want to be American, they are American, and they're not loyal to Japan. And so they really wanted to fight for like that freedom and to fight to protect their families from that incarceration camps.
And the third thing was really surprising with that many medals, you don't even hear to talk about them that much, which is really surprising because they were really just seen with that many medals on the wall, but they never got anything.
Yeah, and you don't hear about them as much in pop culture. I don't think they're in like a Call of Duty game at all. Like it's kind of crazy that you don't hear more about them. Like I said, I mean, it's crazy there's not a movie, because I feel like you could really make a good movie off that. There are some really good books on it. And really a lot of the stuff that's come out has come out in the past 15 years.
Yeah.
To really recognize it. I mean, this was a group that when I was your age in high school, which isn't that long ago, 20 years ago, we wouldn't have talked about. But now they're in most U.S. history textbooks. They're mentioned at least. And obviously in our class, we'll talk about them a lot as we get to that part of the war. So, no, it's very good. Do you guys have any closing thoughts on the 442nd?
Probably one of the toughest military regiments out there. Like by far, this is probably one of the toughest, yeah.
Yeah, during the war.
They need to make a movie about the man George Sakano. They need to make a movie because he brings Rambo energy.
Well, very good, guys. Great job. Glad you enjoyed doing the research. And this was Tigers by the Fire, episode 4. Signing off. Thank you for listening.